the first of the public astronomy lecture series this year, and we had a good run last year in our inaugural season. Our speaker tonight is Dr. Lutz Habersettel, who got his master's and his PhD from the University of Bochum in Germany. He worked on low surface brightness objects. He came here to work as a postdoc and research scientist on galaxies, and he's currently an adjunct professor of astronomy, and he's also a system manager. He has graduate students. He teaches sometimes. He gets grants. He does lots of things here, and he keeps the place going as well. So on this 50th anniversary of Star Trek, yes, we are going to boldly look where no astronomers have looked before. So take it away, Dr. Lutz Habersettel.
Okay, thanks, Darren. So, 50th anniversary of Star Trek. I totally forgot about that.
Am I holding this in your pocket? Or?
In my pocket?
Yeah,
you will not
hold it here. It'll go, just like that.
No.
It'll work.
Okay. So, but we will not start with the future. We will actually start looking a little bit in the past. What I want to try today is just giving a real nice overview over telescopes, how they evolved, how they came to be, and where we are right now, and where we will be maybe in 5 to 10 years. And that is just a quick reminder that as astronomers, our only experimental tools, and that sets us apart from most of our colleagues, is light. And fortunately, light comes in lots of variations. So we have a wide spectrum of photons with different frequencies or wavelengths and energies. And that allows us to actually learn something about the objects which submit the light. Since we are living here on Earth, we are limited through a few things, mainly our atmosphere, which keeps most of the light actually away from us, which is a good thing for us as humans, but not so good thing for us as astronomers. So we have a few windows where we can actually look through, mainly the optical near-infrared window, which is between about 350 nanometer and 2 micrometer. That is that due to that window, our eyes have evolved to be sensitive in the optical range. That's why we see very clearly in the optical. There are a few more windows here in the mid-infrared between 2 micrometer and 15 micrometer. For some, you have to go pretty high up into the mountains to be able to observe. And there's a real big radio window back here where we have wavelengths in the centimeter to meter range. So we as astronomers use mainly two methods to study the universe. First one is we take pictures of the sky, and then we get these nice images of all the objects in there. And the second method is we break down the light into its components. So we take spectra, or we disperse it into the colors, and from these colors we can learn something about the composition of the objects we observe. We see absorption lines, we see continuum emission, and in most cases we actually do a combination of both, because even if we observe the sky and take pictures, we limit the amount of light which comes through by limiting the wavelength range. So we use filters which only allow maybe blue light through or red light, and that already tells us something about the object. For example, if it is very blue, we have usually very young objects there which emit higher energy photons, which usually come to be in the phases where stars are still pretty young and burn hotter. If we have redder light, then usually we have older objects, or we have lower mass objects, especially when it comes to stars. So this is how we analyze the sky. This is how we analyze the objects in the sky and learn something about these objects. So this is just a quick overview. A few technical things you might want to know for the talk. So when we are talking about distances on the sky, so the separation between two objects, we use usually angles to measure those. And a quick reminder, full circle is 360 degrees. 1 degree consists of 60 arc minutes. 1 arc minute consists of 60 arc seconds. Arc seconds are very often used unit in astronomy. If we want to calculate the size of an object in arc seconds, we can use these kind of equation for small angles. And here, just as an example, when we use the Empire State Building with its antenna, which is about 443 meters high, then it would have an angle size of 1 arc second if it were in a distance of 90,000 kilometers. Yeah? So just to get an understanding of these units and measurements we're using. If you look on the sky and you see the full moon, that is about 0.5 degree on the sky. And then you can use your hand, your stretch out arm, and can use that to actually cover certain areas. So if you use your small finger, that is about 1 degree. If you use these three fingers, stretch out arm, you cover about 5 degrees. The fist gives you 10, and the spread out fingers about 20 degrees. So that gives you about a measure actually how little or how much we can observe on the sky. So throughout history, humans started very early on to observe the skies. We have indications that already the Neanderthalians did very thorough observations of the skies and came up with something like a crude moon calendar, indicated by these cave paintings found in Lascaux in France. And here these black dots, which are 28, there are interpretations that these resemble a kind of a lunar calendar. There are also paintings which have clusters of dots which indicate that these might be the Pleiades. So already at 15,000 BC, humans already started to observe the sky and realize that there are constellations and reoccurring events. About 1600 BC, this is an example from this time, a bronze disc found in a little town in Germany called Nebra, the star disc of Nebra, which was produced in that area actually, and which depicts some constellations of the sky. We have here this cluster, which most likely are the Pleiades. Then we go a little bit further. We have in ancient Greece, around 800 BC already, very detailed studies of the sky. 1200 BC, the Babylonians, who came up with the first star catalog, indicated on these stone tablets. And then here the Mesoamerican natives around 1100, they also had very detailed observations of the skies. However, that was all done just with the eye. And then about 1608 came around, and three Dutch citizens, Hans Lippershey, Zacharias Janssen, and Jacob Metius, independently came up with a design for the first very crude telescope. And that kind of started the modern era of astronomy. So the first crude telescopes were refracting telescopes. So they used two lenses, an object lens and objective lens and an eyepiece. And the two lenses were separated so that the focal points of each lens were falling together. The focal points, meaning you have light coming, falling onto your lens. The lens is shaped so that it bends the light to combine in one point, which we call the focal point. And then the same happens with this lens. So combining these two lenses allows you to use this construct for observations. The angular resolution of such an telescope can be estimated using this very simple equation. It depends on the wavelength lambda here and the size of the objective lens. Another number we use to categorize telescopes is the focal ratio, which puts in relation the focal length with the size of the lens or later a mirror. And if this number is small, you have a very fast system, meaning you need less time to get to a certain low limit. If this number is large, so let's say you have very short focal length, then you have a slow system, meaning you need much more time to get to the same depth. So magnification, maybe the most known criterion of telescopes, is nothing else than the relation of the focal length of the objective and the eyepiece. And by changing the eyepiece, we can change the magnification of a telescope. However, there are pros and cons. If we use higher magnifications, we definitely see more details, but what happens is we smear out the, we distribute the light of an object coming to us over much more resolution elements of our detectors, which means our object becomes fainter. We also reduce the field of view, so the field we cover with our telescopes, because one pixel now, or one resolution element of our detectors, either eye or later the digital detectors we use, covers less area. And we also are limited to maybe to atmospheric being something I will talk about a little bit later. If we use a lower magnification, that maybe helps us with the brightness of our object. Now we concentrate the light in a much smaller area because we don't resolve the object that well. We also increase the field of view. Now our resolution elements cover much more area. And the con here is that we see much fewer details of our objects. So these are criteria for refracting telescope. And right after news about the invention by the three Dutch came out, and Galileo Galilei heard about it. According to his own account, he came back to Padua, and within one night he was able to re-engineer the simple design of the Dutch and present his own design to the Dutch, who was very pleased and doubled his salary and converted his position at the University of Padua into a lifelong position. Although he did not invent the telescope, Galileo Galilei was actually the first to use the telescope for astronomical observations, and throughout his career he had many discoveries. He was one of the first to observe the moon and identify craters and mountains on the moon. Back then, the astronomers only had their eyes to observe through telescopes, so what they had to do is actually sketch what they see, and this is one of the sketches of Galileo, showing the different moon phases, showing the craters and the mountains. And he also observed the phases of Venus, found four giant moons around Jupiter, which were named as the Galilean moons. These are Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. He also figured out by observation or from observations of the Milky Way that the Milky Way is actually filled with lots of faint stars. So he used the light gathering power of his telescope to actually see objects which he was not able to see with his naked eye. And he observed the sunspots as one of the first. A few years after Galileo, Galilei, Kepler came up with a new design, and until Galileo Galilei, refracting telescope were made of a convex objective lens and then concave eyepiece lens. Kepler theorized that a telescope with two convex lenses would have many benefits. For example, it would allow to observe much larger fields than the telescopes used by Galileo Galilei. In the following years, people got more or better and better in constructing these telescopes. They were able to produce these glass lenses relatively accurately and grind them into certain shapes. And then they produced these refracting telescopes with enormous focal lengths. So here is one example. We see, in principle, the objective lens sitting up here, and then down here we have an eyepiece which had to be very accurately aligned with the objective lens. And you can imagine that if you have, let me see, that was about 150 feet focal length, or 46 meter, up there, and you have to align that object eyepiece, which is very small, that is a tedious work. And then, considering that the whole construct is dangling off this ballpoint here, so I have to say respect that they even saw something through these types of telescopes. But in the coming or in the following years, the development of telescopes were relatively quick, and we had by the last quarter of the 17th century, we had already telescopes with about 8-inch lenses and focal lengths of up to 200 feet. Now, refracting telescopes have one little problem, and that is actually what we call a chromatic aberration. What that means is that when the light goes through the lens, then light of different wavelengths is not focused in the same focal point. So light of different color has different focal point, and what that leads to, and I hope you can see this down here in this image, first of all, it makes the image blurry, but it also leads to these color effects at the edge. When you try to see here, the blue is a little bit separated. So it's not optimal for astronomical observations, where you want to have the sharpest image you can get. Now, one way around this is using corrector lenses, like this combination here of a convex and concave lens, to allow the focal point of different colors to come back to nearly the same point. Another way to compensate is actually using these extremely long focal lengths, because over the length, the difference is relatively small and neglectable. However, people pretty quickly, in the second half of the 17th century, figured out that there is an easier way of constructing telescopes, and especially making them more compact, easier to handle, and that is when we use a reflecting telescope design. The first one to come up with such a design was James Gregory, and that's what we call today the Gregorianian telescope. And what that does in principle is we have here a parabolic and here a hyperbolic mirror, and our parallel light comes in here, gets reflected of this, what we call the primary mirror, towards the secondary mirror, reflected again, and then through a hole in the center of the primary mirror, and the focal point of that secondary mirror is practically behind the primary mirror. That allows to construct very long focal lengths, but in a very compact telescope design. And by 1668, Isaac Newton came up with his own design. In contrast to the Gregorianian design, he used parabolic mirror as a primary and a flat mirror as a secondary, and he did not utilize a hole in the primary. He guided the light out to the side of the telescope, like you see here. This is a reproduction of his first telescope, so that the observer actually had it a little bit easier. You could put your eyepiece here and look through much more comfortable than before. And again, it's a very compact design compared to refracting telescopes. Then a third of these reflecting telescope designs came from Laurent Cassegrain in 1672. And he actually used similar to the Gregorian telescope, he used a parabolic and a hyperbolic mirror, which put the focal point far beyond the primary mirror and allowed for very accurate observations. By the beginning of the 18th century, people actually figured out various methods to very accurately design aspheric and parabolic metal mirrors. So were the first generations of mirrors. These were metal mirrors which were brought in shape and then coated with thin layers of silver. One of the disadvantages of these mirrors is over time the coating loses quality and the reflective quality goes down. So you have to recoat it from time to time. With these metal mirrors, you had to reshape them every time you scraped off the coating, something which would be solved much later than when glass mirrors became standard. But by 1721, people like John Hadley became master in producing these metal mirrors in various shapes. And by the end of the 18th century, another design emerged, because we have to keep in mind, whenever we bring an additional element, optical element, in our light path, we lose light. That means that we reduce the limiting depth to which we can observe. So people wanted to get the maximum light out of it, and they didn't want to put objects into the central mirror because of shading effects, and which in the end reduces the effective collecting area for your mirror. So one design which came up came from William Herschel, and what he did is actually he tilted his primary mirror a little bit so that when the light gets reflected, it got actually reflected outwards to the top of the telescope, so he didn't need to put a secondary mirror here. He could easily observe from that place and could put an eyepiece or could put his head there. By that time, he built a telescope which had a mirror size of 49 inches or 1.2 meters. So it's a very impressive telescope size for that time. We still don't have a 1.2 meter telescope here in our astronomy group. So very impressive work. The focal length of that instrument was about 40 feet. By 1842, astronomer called William Pearson, the third Earl of Rose, he built the largest telescope in the world. at that time with a mirror size of 1.80 meters or 72 inch and a focal length of 53 feet. The telescope was named the Levesian of Parsonstown, and it was the largest telescope for quite some time. He was able, using that telescope, to actually observe extragalactic objects like M51 here. He resolved the spiral arms of that spiral galaxy. Here in the images you see a reproduction of that telescope, which is still existent. Here is one, actually this is one of the two surviving original mirrors of that telescope. And here you see the black tube pointing downwards. Then by the mid of the 19th century, actually that method came up, developed by Carl August von Steinhell and Leon Foucault, which allowed to coat glass now with very thin layers of silver, which had a much higher reflectivity, which is good because we reach much deeper limits with shorter times. And as I mentioned before, it's much easier to remove and recoat. So after a few years under dry or sandy conditions, and your mirror lost 20-30% of its reflectivity, you could easily remove your silver coat and recoat it without having to go through the ordeal of reshaping the mirror, because that is a very difficult process of grinding and takes very long, several months, to get that in perfect shape. By the end of the 19th century, the largest ever built refracting telescope came to be. That was the Yerkes Observatory 40-inch. That means this telescope used a glass lens of 1 meter diameter. And that is pretty much where you reach your physical limits. Because at that point, glass lenses get so heavy that they start to sag. And that means they lose their shape. When they lose their shape, you don't get sharp images anymore. So 1 meter lens at the Yerkes Observatory 40-inch refractor, that was the largest refracting telescope ever used for astronomical research. And here you see an image of that glass lens. Here you see the full telescope. In the mid of the 19th century, a new technology, photography, which came up, I think about around 1830 or so, also made its way into astronomy. Until then, people just had to use their eyes and sketch whatever they saw. Now it was possible to actually take pictures of through a telescope. And by 1851, the first successful picture of a solar eclipse was taken by Dr. August Ludwig Busch and a photographer from whom only the family name is known, Berkowski, and here is a copy of that image. Then later in the 19th century, people like Henry Draper started to use photography on a regular basis. They successfully photographed the moon in, or actually his father did in 1840. He actually took in 1872 the first spectrum ever taken through a telescope, and that was of the star Vega. He could show the absorption lines in the spectrum. And then a few years later, in 1880, he made a first long exposure, 51 minutes, of the Orion Nebula, which you see here. That was taken with an 11-inch refractor. And you see it's relatively low resolution, relatively crude. And then a few years later, one of his colleagues, Andrew Ansley Common, took a 60-minute exposure through a 36-inch reflecting telescope. And you see larger mirror, much higher resolution, and we see much more details in the images. We see much fainter details too. So photography kind of changed the game within astronomy, because now it became possible for astronomers to actually really measure something, to really take pictures and analyze them, and not have to rely on crude sketches from astronomers who maybe misidentified features and so on. And it could much more easily archived. So by that time, by the turn of the century, 1908, and later in 1917, very large telescopes were built, 16-inch Hale telescope and the 100-inch telescope, both at Mount Wilson Observatory. I think both telescopes are still in use today.
Mount Wilson.
Yeah.
Yeah,
this, especially the 100-inch, was heavily used by an astronomer called Edwin Hubble. Most of you should know that name. He lived for 1 year here in Louisville between 1913 and 1914, and he was the first to prove that the Andromeda Nebula, which was thought until then to be part of our own Milky Way, that this nebula was actually his own galaxy and was not part of the Milky Way. And here is one of the observations he took, one of the photographic plates. That was in 1923. Later in 1921, together with Humason, the two showed that the universe is actually expanding. They could measure the rate of expansion and came up with the first very crude size estimation for the known universe. And the way they did this is they used a relation which exists between the distance of galaxies or redshift and the distance we derive with Cepheids. Cepheids are variable stars, and that and they have a very distinct period luminosity relation, which was shown a few years earlier by Henrietta Leavitt. I think Henrietta, right? And that means if we very accurately know the luminosity, then we can calculate from there the distance of the object we see by measuring its apparent brightness. And the luminosity could be derived by how often or how quick these stars change their brightness. So Hubble used that relation and came up with a relation between the distance and the expansion or the redshift of galaxies, so how quick galaxies move away from each other. And this is this very simple relation here. So the speed with which galaxies move away from each other correlates to the distance of the galaxies with this constant, which we call the Hubble constant. Back in, when he did these observations, the constant Hubble constant he came up with was about 500 kilometers per second per megaparsec, which is far too high. Today we know that this constant is more in the order of 63 kilometers per second per megaparsec. By 1930, so with the invention of reflecting telescopes, one problem came to be, and that was that only smaller fields could be observed, and that is one part of the design of the telescopes. So to overcome this, by 1930, an astronomer called Bernhard Schmidt introduced a new design for telescopes called the Schmidt telescope, and here is one famous one from an observatory here in the U.S. And what this does, and I hope you can see this, so we have the problems with these mirrors we use is actually their shape. So we have a spherical mirror And these are easy to make. And they have a wide field of view. But the problem is that they do not focus light from different areas into the same focal point. So we would have not have a sharp image. So so that is called a spherical aberration. We could overcome that problem by using parabolic mirrors, which bring light from the outer parts into the same focal point. But if we have off-axis light, so that means light from another object, which is not on the same optical axis as the other object, that is now out of focus. That means we only can observe very narrow fields. And as I said, to overcome that problem, Schmidt proposed the following design. He used a spherical mirror, which allows to observe very large fields, and then he introduced a correcting lens in the light path, which bends the light in a way so that when it gets reflected, all light gets focused in one point. And these Schmidt cameras were, until the 80s, were very famous for taking large surveys of the sky because they could observe these large areas on the sky, something which other reflecting telescopes could not do. So, and here we have two of these famous Schmidt telescopes. They are actually two of the largest, which have correcting lenses in the order of 1.25 meters. And they are at the Palomar Observatory in California. This is this one over here, and the other one is at the in Australia, the UK Schmidt in Australia. So by the mid of the 20th century, the race for telescope size went on, and we reached about 200 inch or 5 meters. That is the famous 200 inch Hale telescope at Mount Palomar. That telescope became the largest telescope until 1975, until the Russians built their 6 meter telescope. So by the mid, or let's say around the end of the 50s, beginning of the 60s, many countries actually started to support astronomy very strongly. So they started to fund and establish these large observatories, and these observatories became centers for astronomical research. And we have, for example, here the European Southern Observatory, or ESO, which had an observatory in southern Chile on La Silla that was established in 64. Here in the U.S., two famous observatories, the Kitt Peak National Observatory, funded in 58, and later the Cerro Tololo, the Kitt Peak Observatory is in Arizona, in southern Arizona near Tucson. It's actually in, you can go there if you're ever in Tucson. You should drive up to Kitt Peak and take a tour of the telescopes there. There is a 4 meter telescope, 2 meter, and a few smaller ones. And there's also a solar tower you can visit. The other observatory is the Cerro Tololo Observatory, or CTIO, Cerro Tololo Inter-American Observatory, which is also located in Chile and which was established in 65. Later, I think in the mid-80s, the U.S. Created the NOAO, which is the National Optical Astronomical Observatory, which took over both observatories and functions as organizing organization. In Europe, we have an observatory in southern Spain, funded by or established by the German astronomical community. It's the Calo Alto Observatory that has a 4 meter, 2 meter, and a 1 meter. That 1 meter you see over here is exactly 1.25 meter telescope. I spent many, many nights on this one. Very cold nights, often bad nights. But luckily, they have a very good pool table there, so we could at least use the time.
There's wine in the vending machine, too.
Oh, yeah, the wine. So, over the last 15 years, we actually reached sizes with telescopes beyond 4 meter, and these telescopes now open up very deep parts of the universe. We have the very famous Keck Observatory, which has two 10-meter telescopes. These telescopes have segmented mirrors, which you can see here. The observatory is on Mauna Kea on Hawaii. And the first of the two Keck telescopes saw first light in 1993. The second followed 3 years later. The ESO or European Southern Observatory built his 8-meter facility on a mountain in northern Chile, Paranal. That's in the Atacama Desert, a very dry environment. Has 4 8-meter telescopes there. We have the Las Campanas Observatory, which has the 2 6.5 Magellan, and another very successful telescopes are the 2 Geminis. One is on the northern hemisphere on Hawaii, and one is in the southern hemisphere in Chile. And finally, the Large Binocular Telescope, which is an 8.4-meter or 2 8.4-meter telescope. Both look always in the same direction. They are on the same mounting. So sometimes people claim this is actually the largest optical telescope in the world, because if you combine the two mirrors, you have an effective aperture of 11 meters, so a little bit larger than the Keck's actually. But this is just telescope design, and with the new technology in observing, actually, besides telescope design, the instrument design became much, much more important, or at least as important as the, building larger and larger telescopes. So in 1975, a famous invention came up, the charged coupled device, or CCD, which got a Nobel Prize in 2009 for George Smith and Willard Boyle. Both worked at Bell Laboratories and came up with this way of transferring charges from one register to the other by using potentials and moving these electrical charges from one register to another until they could be read out. Combine this with photoelectric materials, something for which Albert Einstein got a Nobel Prize in 1921, and you have your CCD camera, which every one of us nowadays carries with a cell phone. But back in the mid-70s, this was a very revolutionary approach, and it started to replace the photo plates. Nowadays we have these huge cameras like here with multiple large CCDs, and they allow us to cover larger and larger areas on the sky. Here, for example, we have the NOAO mosaic imager, which has 2048 by 4096 pixel chips, and which give us about 67 megapixels. We can observe half a degree by half a degree roughly on the sky. VISTA, which is one of the newer telescopes on Paranal, has a camera, VIRCAM, which has 16 of these chips, also about 67 megapixels, but it covers about 1.5 degrees on the sky. Another game changer is spectroscopy, because now we can really look into how are these objects composed. So we see, we can identify molecules, we can identify how stars are built, and so on. And these spectrographs, they started out pretty simple. So what you do in principle is you block out most of the light. You just let the light through this little slit here for, let's say, one object. That light falls on a dispersing element, like a prisma here. The light gets spread up and separated out. And on your detector, you can measure this light. And you see the different colors. You see the absorption lines and so on. Here is one of these examples for a long slit spectrograph on one of the VLTs. That's FORCE, is that spectrograph called. And here we see one of these images. So you see here is actually, that's the object. That's the what we call the dispersion direction. So that in this direction, the wavelengths are spread out. Then you see these bright lines here. These are lines which are produced by our night sky and have to be corrected out. But you already see here these little bumps. These are emission lines, and this looks like a galaxy which has been observed here. Now, single object spectroscopy takes very long and is not very efficient. So a few years back, people came up with the idea to build these multi-object spectrographs. These allow to observe many, many objects in one shot, and we have two examples here. Flamingos 2, which is currently at Gemini South, which is a near-infrared multi-object spectrograph. It can take up to 80 slits per mask. So what they do, here in this other example, which is the VMOS spectrograph at the VLT, you have these plates here, and you see this dashes on these plates. These are little slits which get cut into these plates. So what you do is you get first an image of the sky you want to observe. You identify the objects you are interested in, and then you send a list with coordinates to the observatory, and they produce these masks where they cut very accurate little slitlets in these plates, and then these plates get loaded into your instrument. And as I said, Flamingos, which does this these multi-object spectroscopy in the near-infrared, can hold up to 80 slits on one mask and can load nine masks at once. That means every time you have to put new masks in, you have to decompress your instrument. These CCDs are put into a very cold environment, so they are cooled down with liquid nitrogen, and they are in a vacuum environment. So when you want to load a new mask, you first have to open this, put new masks in. So it's a very long process. So per night, you can observe about nine different masks. And the observations for flamingos range between about a micron and 2.5 microns, so exactly the near-infrared. That's where we either can observe nicely high redshift galaxies, or we can observe lower mass stars, or older stars. VMOS observes more in the optical, between 360 nanometers and 1 micrometer. It can hold a few more slits on the mask. It's up to 200 slits per mask. And the imager is made out of 4 quadrants. So you have per exposure 4 different masks. So that means up to 800 objects in one exposure. So you are 800 times faster than doing a single slit observation. The next development in spectroscopy came with fiber spectroscopy and so-called integral field units. And here we see an example for a fiber spectrograph that is hectospec at the multimirror telescope. It's a 6.5 meter telescope, which you see here. I was there observing a few years back. And what they actually do is, so again, you produce your image, you have your coordinate list for your object, and you send it to them, and then in the night when they observe, they load this into a computer, and then a command tells little robots to position these fibers at the appropriate positions. And the heads of these little fibers, you see here the fibers going out, and they sit exactly over your object. So this instrument can observe up to 300 fibers. The advantage of a fiber spectrograph is actually, well, when you use a slit mask, you still have to deal with orientation and position of your objects on the CCD. With a fiber, you can use the full width or length of your CCD because you can position your fiber optimal on your CCD without losing any space, without having problems with overlap with other objects. So that was a big advantage in doing multi-object spectroscopy. Another technology is the so-called integral field unit technology. What this does in principle is it does a combination of taking images and spectra from objects. You have several different units which slice your object along a spectral axis but still give you a 2D image of your object. All these instrumentations, what they require is very good conditions, and one problem we have is turbulences in the atmosphere, so what we call seeing, and what that leads to is actually this blurring of objects. It makes images look fuzzier, and the reason is that we have little cells in the upper atmosphere. Size of these cells is in the order of 30 centimeters, and these change very rapidly. And this change, the more often they change, the worse gets your seeing condition. So what you want to actually have is very smooth air with very slow change. And here is how that would look like. So we have go from left to right, high resolution to low resolution, and good seeing to bad seeing. And if you have two objects you usually can separate under bad seeing condition, they morph into one and you lose details. So that brings up the question where we actually want to put observatories, and actually the best places are actually on mountains. You want to be at least 2,000 meters up. That means you want to be above the inversion layer. That's where you have very smooth air, the best seeing conditions. You want to be actually near the ocean because a constant stream of air from the ocean produces a very smooth airflow and very little turbulences. And you want to have a dry climate, so you want to put your observatory in a desert maybe. And most likely you want to be away from cities because unlike in the 18th or 17th century, nowadays, if you live near a larger city, and here's one example, that's Orem in Utah with a population of 500,000 people, you produce so much light in these cities that something like the Orion becomes a very, very bad image. You almost cannot see the brighter stars in here. And here you see the situation of light pollution nowadays. So east coast of the U.S. is one of the worst areas to put an observatory. Even at the west coast, some of these traditional observatories like Mount Wilson or Mount Palomar have problems with light pollution from cities like L.A. or San Diego. So the best areas nowadays are actually in South America, and especially in Chile. You might want to go to Texas. That's another area. But the best observatories are actually in Chile and on Hawaii at over 4,000 meters altitude, or in Arizona in the desert, Kitt Peak. There you have seeing conditions which are in the order of half an arc second to arc seconds, maybe even better. Here in Kentucky, for example, at our Moore Observatory, we would get 2 or 3 arcseconds as seeing conditions. So much, much worse. You don't want to put an 8 meter here. You rather want to go to a place like Mauna Kea. To overcome limitations with seeing, another technology came up a few years ago, and that's adaptive optics. Adaptive optics, what that does is, in principle, it corrects disturbances in the wavefront due to our atmosphere. It measures these disturbances and corrects either by adjusting the shape of the secondary mirror or adjusting the shape of an element within the optical path of your instrument. It's very difficult or impossible to actually adjust the shape of the primary, because you have to do, for adaptive optics, you have to do this about 1,000 times per second, and that would require a very thin a mirror which can be vibrate at these high frequencies, and usually primary mirrors are not that thin. So you do this with a secondary or with another element in your optical pathway. Now, to figure out what the disturbance of your wavefront actually is, you use what we call a laser guide star. And what these observatories do is they shoot up a laser in the sky and then measure the light of this laser, because they know exactly how the laser looks like when he gets shot in the sky, and they now see how they measure it. They know what our atmosphere does to the light. Unfortunately, it brightens up the sky a little bit, and it's also limited in size and field of view you can observe. You have to have this very nearby your observations. Another method to overcome effects by seeing is what we call lucky imaging. It's still an experimental method and gets mainly used at smaller telescopes. What that does is it takes very short exposures, 100 milliseconds or less. At those short exposure times, you can assume that your atmosphere doesn't change a lot. And then what you do is you look through your images, and you have images with bad seeing, with good seeing, and then you combine parts of it. If you combine all of it, you see everything gets smeared out in this blob. Now you only take the best 50%, and you already start to see that there is structure in your blob. And if you go down to only take the best 1% of images, then you all of a sudden see two different separated images. However, that method is very limited to bright objects due to the very short exposure times, and not really a valid object method for large telescopes like VLTs and so on. Here again, just to show how these adaptive optics system works. So you have a system which measures the disturbances in the wavefront, and then corrects it with a tilted optical element, and feeds that then into your science instrument. Now, you can overcome seeing problems by actually going outside our atmosphere, so going out into space, and that's what we have done for a very long time now. One of the most successful instruments, the Hubble Space Telescopes, which was launched in 1990 with the Space Shuttle Discovery, has a 2.5 meter mirror and can observe from the optical to the near infrared. This telescope was is still in an Earth near orbit. That means it was able to actually be repaired and upgraded 4 times very successfully. The last mission was Service Mission 4, about, when was that, 2009, yeah, six, 7 years ago. And during that upgrade, it got a complete new set of instruments, new imager, very high quality. With this telescope, you can produce the highest resolution images, and it took these famous pictures here with the pillars of creation. These are gas clouds which form new stellar systems. However, this is in the optical. We also have observatories in outer space which observe in other wavelength range. Here we have two satellites which do observations in the near infrared and in the mid infrared all the way to the far infrared, Spitzer and Herschel. With these wavelengths, you can observe things like dust in galaxies. It tells you something about the composition of galaxies and how dust plays a role in their evolution. And then we have on the shorter wavelength end of the spectrum, we have GALAX, which observes UV radiation. That means you observe hot gas or you observe young stars which produce the UV photons. And then you go all the way to the X-ray with XMM. That's where you observe very hot gas, million degrees gas with between galaxies and galaxy clusters, for example, or you observe high energetic sources like supernovae in galaxies. And if you combine all these observations, it gives you a pretty good understanding of galaxies. You see how extended they are. You have the high energy sources here. You have lower mass stars and dust from infrared observations. You see how that is located in the disk. And you have the optical light from stars. So for the future, we have a few, or there are a few telescope projects in the make. The next one to actually get launched is the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, the LSST, which will be located at Cerro Pachón in north central Chile. And that telescope will have the largest CCD camera ever built. That camera has 3.2 gigapixels and has a field of view of 3.5 degrees. We finally come back to times where we use glass plates which could cover these large areas. Now with CCD's cameras, we are also able to observe these larger fields again. And this telescope will survey the southern sky, the whole southern sky every 3 days in five different filter bands. And the science goals will be the nature of dark matter, understanding of dark energy. We will catalog the solar system a little bit better, so looking for much fainter objects, and the structure and formation of the Milky Way, and especially, and that is due to very short exposure times, in the order of 30 seconds per exposure, we will have time resolution which allows to search for lots of variable objects like supernovae. And I'm proud to announce here that actually a consortium here in Kentucky is now the newest member of the LSST Science Corporation, and that's the Kentucky Association for Research with LSST, and this consortium came to be thanks to great support by NASA and Kentucky EPCOR, and especially by the relentless work and determination of Dr. Willeker over here, who made that a reality this summer. So we are now officially, and University of Louisville is part of this consortium, as are many other universities here in Kentucky, UK, Moorhead, Bellarmine, Eastern Kentucky. These are all members of the CAL consortium, and we are the newest member of the LSST Science Corporation. Very proud moment. So then, on the optical telescope side, two very exciting projects, extremely large telescopes, extremely large meaning diameters of more than 20 meters. The first one to start to observe in most likely 20, 25, or actually a few years earlier, it will have first light, will be the giant Magellan telescope, which will have a 25.5-meter segmented mirror, which means it actually consists of seven different mirrors. Each mirror is about 8.4 meters. And that will also be located in Chile. And the other project is a 39.3 meter telescope from ESO, the European Extremely Large Telescope at Cerro Amazonas, which is right around the corner from Paranal, and which is a mountain where my old university has actually a telescope on. And that will consist of about almost 800 1.45 meter mirrors, also segmented. With that size, you will not be able to build monolithic mirrors. These mirrors get cast melting glass and then rotating to get the shapes. And there's a size limit. Most of the mirrors, also the mirrors for GMT, are actually produced in Arizona, in Tucson, right under the football field. The Stewart Observatory has a mirror lab there, and there they have a rotating oven which can produce mirrors up to 8.4 meters, roughly. Here, the secondary will be an adaptive optics secondary, and that will have about 6,000 actuators, meaning 6,000 points where the mirror can be pulled and pushed to be brought into shape, and that happens 1,000 times per second. So that will produce unseen angular resolutions in the order of 0.001 arc seconds. Up to 0.65 arc seconds, all depends on the wavelength of the light you observe. First light is expected for 2024. We will see. Usually these projects run over with time and usually also with budget. The other very exciting project for the future is James Webb Space Telescope, or JWST, that will kind of replace the Hubble Space Telescope. It will get a 2.5-meter segmented mirror. Here you already see the first few segments of that mirror. Here we have the heat shield. It is designed to observe in the optical, but the red part of the optical up to the mid-infrared, so between 0.6 and 28.5 micrometer. That requires that the instruments are kept very, very cold, because at these wavelengths, you thermal radiation, so the body heat, for example, of you, produces a lot of background emission, which we don't want to have. And to achieve this, usually satellites carry liquid helium with them and cool these instruments down to very low temperatures. However, liquid helium runs out after a while, and then your satellite is not usable anymore. What the design for the JWST brings is that the telescope actually gets stationed very far out. It will be stationed at Lagrange point L2 and will point always away from the sun. Then this heat shield here will prevent the instrument from heating up, and hopefully that way we can have use out of this telescope for many, many years. Yeah, so that's for the future projects. Here, just a nice graphic which shows where we from where we came with about 1 meter telescopes here, the Yerkes 40-inch, all the way now to 40-meter multi-mirror telescopes. And yeah, the future looks bright. And thanks for your attention. Yeah, then one part is actually is complete coverage. You lose a little bit, but okay, that's not too big.
real disadvantages, yeah, actually, I wouldn't know. It's more the advantage of having an easier time to build them when you go into these sizes. If you when you go about 40 meters, the advantages they are definitely.
You
need to, yeah, the positioning, that one of the problems, but that is solved for a few years now, is to get, so what you have to do is actually form this parabolic shape with different mirrors, putting different mirrors together. Usually if you have a monolithic one, you grind your mirror in a certain shape, and that shape stays. Now with segmented mirrors, each mirror separate, you have to orient them in a way to produce this shape. That was a little bit of a problem in the beginning, but Keck did a very good job with it. I think the 10 meter in Texas suffered a lot under it. No, it's
now
impossible.
The big 8 meters now actually have a mirror which is quite thin.
Yeah.
And the reason they do that is
it's weight issue.
And
yeah.
Also, you need your telescope to be the same temperature as the outside. If you have a giant piece of glass, it will hold the heat. As the night gets cooler, you'll have your telescope hotter than the environment, and then it gets a little air.
Yeah, I did not go into these details, but yes. That for monolithic mirrors, that's a big problem. The larger they get, they have to get very thin. But then, yes, exactly. Then, so what they usually do nowadays is they don't have one monolithic glass block. What they do is they build a honeycomb structure in that mold before they put the glass in, before they melt the glass, which supports and stiffens the mirror.
It's a rib structure.
Yeah. It's a very stiff material. It's usually, that's a kind of...
You can add things to glass and then it doesn't expand very much in temperature. But you still, even on the big glass mirrors, you have to have to put some pistons and actuators on the back to correct for all this. It's called active.
Yeah, I did not put that on the slides. That was in principle before we got to adaptive optics. We had a method called active optics, where you had these actuators behind your mirror, and several times through the night you would measure your wavefront and then adjust by pulling and pushing your mirror into shape. Nowadays with these huge large mirrors, which are heavy and tend to lose their shape, you use these active actuators all the time. Yeah. But in terms of disadvantage, since people learned how to deal with positioning the segmented mirrors very accurately, I think there's not a real disadvantage in having segmented mirrors. It's more of an advantage. You have your weight issue under control better. You even can think about paying for it. It's building a monolith. The idea of producing a 40 meter monolithic mirror that would take, I think, a decade to even cool down or longer. You have to think of the size. If you melt glass, an 8 meter mirror already takes several months to cool down to a point where they can open the chamber and start grinding and polish the mirror. So all these problems go away with segmented mirrors, but of course you can produce them in smaller size and can kind of mass produce them then.
And even in space, the James Webb Space Telescope produced a mirror that has
full glass. That's even worse. James Webb, let's see, can we see this?
It has a wonderful much flower.
Yeah, these are very thin mirrors.
They're gold plated.
Yeah. Yeah, but that is because of near infrared. So these mirrors here, actually, these are the first few assembled. They fold together
in a certain pattern and get very tightly packed to fit into the top of a rocket. And then once the satellite reaches its orbit, this is here very thin foil, as you can see, that will unfold, and then this whole structure will unfold. I think in the end it's not much bigger than this inner part here. So it has to be very thin, very light, but still very stable. Now, since it is positioned at L2, you don't have the thermal components so much. So it's always down to minus
40 Kelvin.
Yeah, 40 Kelvin, something minus
230
Celsius. Yeah. So you don't have expansion and contraction due to temperature changes. That's what also the heat shield is for.
Pretty impressive piece of equipment.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's also a very expensive piece of equipment. That's the projected budget right now. Once we have launch, and that doesn't include running the observation for 10 years or whatever. Yeah.
Big toys.
I wouldn't call them toys, but big, yes.
Okay. It is 9 o'clock.
Yeah. And I left out many areas of different wavelengths. We have a lot of projects going on with radio telescopes. There are new radio arrays in Chile and in South Africa built. So there's a lot of development going on currently.